first part should be known in this contract as the party of the first part.
The witness will comply under the, this I got a C rule.
Judge Hurd is stumped by this case. I've also misplaced my judge hammer.
The justice system works swiftly in the future now that they've abolished all lawyers.
My client will suggest that your client drives my client back to your client's flat, where your client will play some James Taylor.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 517. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How you doing?
I'm fantastic. I feel like we're in a little bit of a time warp, right? Like,
yeah.
Doing a rapid response on a Tuesday. It seems crazy.
Reverse the polarity.
Yeah.
We're doing the rapid response Tuesday. Weird. Yep. So it's not as rapid, but it is a response. Well, I think we've got so much to do. We better get to it.
Let's do it. All right.
Down. Down. Great news on the Cuomo front. Cuomo resigned. That's good to hear because obviously that guy was a creep. And those, I got even more into the details of the allegations against him. And it's just gross, man. Just so much gross stuff with the state trooper as well. I mean, it's all awful. And I'm glad he's gone. And good job, Democrats, for actually policing our own and getting a Democratic governor out of a spot. I mean, that says a lot about our party. And it's, by comparison, a lot about Republicans, I think.
It absolutely does. And we got zero well-actually emails defending Cuomo, yeah. Which is real good. And I want to point out, though, just to continue to ward off those potential arguments, we linked it in the show notes on episode 515. I'm going to link it in the show notes again. The 168-page report prepared by the New York Attorney General's office using two well-respected outside law firms that came in, right? So as arm's length as possible, concluded with, quote, "The governor engaged in conduct that constituted sexual harassment under federal and state law," end of quote. Furthermore, that the executive branch failed to follow internal policies. That's not quite proof of obstruction of justice, right? But it is part of the evidence that you would take into account, right? In saying, like, you know, when we said Trump obstructed justice by telling inspectors general, yeah, I know you're supposed to send that on to Congress, but why don't you just send that to Bill Barr instead, right? Like, irregularities in process are often evidence of obstruction of justice. Those two things, right? So you emphasized the credible nature of the allegations. If you were straw-botting the Cuomo position, I don't think any of those arguments would survive an independent investigation conducted at arm's length by members of your party concluded that you committed multiple crimes.
Yeah. Right?
Like that's it. That's enough.
Case closed.
All right. So that poses a couple of different questions, right? And the terminal one we're going to get to, right, which is, can the impeachment still proceed against Governor Cuomo, right? Lots of people want to know these sorts of things. That's
the parallel to Trump, where it's like there's still a reason if you want to keep him from office in the future, there's still plenty of reason to do it, right?
Yeah, no, and let's jump ahead to that. As we discussed in episode 515, section 24 of Article 6 of the New York State Constitution has the exact same language that would be replicated in the U.S. Constitution a decade later, right? It says, judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office or removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any public office of honor, trust, or profit under this state. And so absolutely to say, this is somebody who should not hold statewide office again. And given the last name and the family history, that strikes me as not an implausible thing to say, right? Mm-hmm. To say, yeah, we want there to be actual consequences. And resigning with a year left, you know, having served 7 of 8 years as governor, we're not sure that's consequences. I can understand that argument. Whether the heavily Democratic New York legislature will follow through on that, I don't know. But they certainly are entitled to, for that reason. It is an unsettled question at the New York state level, but again, only for the reasons that it, you know, hasn't been tried. But there seems to be, just in an exact parallel, there seems to be all of the reasons why this could proceed against Donald Trump are reasons that it could proceed against Andrew Cuomo. So we'll be following. We'll take a look at that. Mm-hmm. I also thought it was worth talking about Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, who is going to take over. It'll be in about a week and a half by the time you hear this. This is part of the reason we didn't need to get it out immediately on Friday, because Cuomo resigned with I need 2 weeks to clean out my desk, I guess. Mm-hmm. But she will become the first female governor of the state of New York. She is described as having served one term in Congress. It's actually kind of an interesting situation. She won a special election in 2011 after Republican Representative Chris Lee resigned on sort of a karmic scale. Chris Lee resigned from sending unsolicited requests on Craigslist to a young woman. And then that woman went to the press, was like, "Aren't you that congressman?" And he was like, "Delete, delete, 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 delete." And then she went to the press and he resigned. Hochul won that special election, served for a little over a year. And then that district, New York 26th, was redistricted into New York 27 because New York lost 2 seats during the 2010 census. And as part of the redistricting process, the district went from being a toss-up to being an R plus 25 district. Despite that disparity, she only lost to Chris Collins by a point and a half in 2012. That new New York 27 has elected nothing but Republicans since. It went for Trump by 24 points in 2016 and by 15 points in 2020. So she won in an area and then did very well even when it became heavily more Republican. Hochul then ran for lieutenant governor in 2014, won, and then Cuomo, Hochul were reelected in 2018. She has already said that she is prepared to run for reelection in 2022. So
as governor, though, right?
As yeah. Governor.
That's and right. I also, like she said, like one way or the other, no matter what happens, this won't be a toxic work environment. Yeah, and yeah. I just was like, you know, it sucks that you have to say that. That should be like a bare minimum that any possible governor would fulfill. But no, you need to be said, and I appreciated it.
Yep. And let's also point out, you know, we're putting our money where our mouth is in the sense that we don't have a lot of evidence about Hochul's politics. It seems as though she is a more centrist Democrat. She has previously used the label independent Democrat to describe herself in 2012 in Congress. Now, again, there are a lot of caveats that you could put here. As we were pointing out, right, she was being redistricted into an R plus 25 district, right? There's a lot of good reasons to say I'm an independent Democrat. She actually cast a vote. She was one of 17 Democrats in Congress who joined with a partisan Republican finding that Attorney General Eric Holder was in contempt of Congress for withholding documents related to Operation Fast and Furious, which is a Republican cause celeb. And that is what it is. She did that in 2012. According to GovTrack, she voted with the Democratic Party 84.2% of the time, which ranked 169th among 192 House Democrats during the term in which she was in office. GovTrack describes her as a centrist Democratic follower. And the word follower is there because she sponsored one piece of legislation during her time in office. So those are negative signs. The counter argument that I would point to and that we've talked about on the show is that Kirsten Gillibrand had a similarly you know, more conservative, more centrist record in the House before being appointed to the Senate, and I think has been pretty good for progressives and for progressive politics. So that's the political side. But again, as you and I have pointed out, right, like we're willing to take that risk. It's
well,
important.
Also, again, yeah. I mean, she'll be running for re-election very yep. soon.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll find out, I guess.
That's exactly right. On the flip side, I think she has taken a strong but appropriate stance with respect to the Cuomo allegations, right? So another question that people have asked us is, could Hochul pardon Cuomo?
Why
follow
would she,
the Jerry Ford? That, and that's exactly the right answer. Yes. Yes, she could. But why would she? Right? That doesn't seem to be any reason to do that.
Question. Sorry to interrupt. I know every time we've talked pardons in the past 5 years, it's always been state versus federal. Some of these crimes that it seems like Cuomo's guilty of, they would strike me as more equal protection-y workplace. They sound kind of federal to me, but am I wrong there? Are they state-level crimes that she even could pardon him for?
No, you are absolutely right. Like, the protections overlap, and
right.
they're absolutely would be the potential for finding a violation of federal law, even if he were pardoned. Now, I think the likelihood that a criminal prosecution is ever investigated, well,
we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, let me not. I stopped midstream there. Yeah. I was going to say, I still think it's low,
yeah.
but I don't want to say that it's zero. You cut to the chase on the right answer, though, which is that Hochul has been, she said immediately, I find this behavior repulsive and unlawful. I believe the women who have accused Andrew Cuomo. And then she said, look, I have not called upon Governor Cuomo to resign because Lieutenant Governor stand next to the line of succession,
yeah.
and it would not be appropriate to comment further on the process, which is this is the right
That's
thing
fair.
To say.
Yeah.
So she was asked if Cuomo were convicted on any potential criminal charges, and she said it is far too premature to even have those conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And then with respect to impeachment, and I think this is a pretty strong signal. She says, I've been in this business long enough to know that it is not the purview of the New York State governor to dictate to the New York State Assembly or to the Judiciary Committee on what actions they should take next with respect to anything, particularly impeachment.
That's a big contrast to Cuomo, right?
Yeah. So that's if you guys think about going ahead, you can go ahead.
Well, not only that, I mean, there's been so many, if I have it right, so many reports of Cuomo just being awful with and just trying to dominate the legislature all the time and, you know, just bad relationships there. So I feel like that's an additional dig, but I could be reading into it too much.
No, I think that's right. And the other comment of note was that Governor, soon to be Governor Hochul said, there will be turnover of the current governor's staff.
Yeah, anyone who enabled that atmosphere for sure.
Yep. And the report, like I said, 168 pages, absolutely details. Again, it comes short of obstruction of justice, right? It does not say that Andrew Cuomo instructed the executive branch to disregard its standard procedures. It says, right, the executive unit failed to follow its internal guidelines. So the standard that you would use to charge somebody criminally is way different than the standard of, hey, does this person get to continue in their job or not? You're absolutely correct.
I wanted to sneak in a question I saw real quick that I honestly feel like I should have asked, and it's not regarding the Cuomo part, but the Newsom part. There must be some little rule that stops this from happening. But somebody asked us, you know, why can't Gavin Newsom just resign, prevent the recall? That way there's no risk of we elect whoever the heck, some right wing, whatever, resign. And then the lieutenant governor of California becomes the governor. And is that a get out of recall free process?
Great question. The answer, as far as I can tell, is yes. So it creates that kind of crazy, perverse incentive, though, where you're like, okay, but, you know, does that give them what they want, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I mean, Gavin Newsom is not somebody who is without ambition, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And to say, like,
so it's purely a political constraint that prevents this from happening.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I'm imagining Shenanigans. That should be my new band name. Imagine Shenanigans. where it's like, at what point? But this didn't happen with Gray Davis, so I assume there's, maybe it's just, but again, different era. Maybe in today's hardball era, who knows if it would be a different thing. But, you know, the minute the results don't look good, well, I resign, you know, or something like that, to get the lieutenant governor in there. And then would the recall process fizzle? You know, like you recalled a governor that wasn't governor, and you let's say the recall it's just about to go through, you know, and Newsom's going to lose and some just awful Trumpian, you know, horrible person is going to win. Could Gavin Newsom, is there any timing trick in there to just be like, I'm out. Lieutenant Governor, sorry, the recall doesn't work.
So the recall is directed against a particular individual inhabitant of the office. And the threshold question is, you know, should you remove Gavin Newsom from the office of Governor of California? As far as I can tell, no one's ever tried the resign moots. But yeah. It seems very clearly to me, right? Like, I'm envisioning what would happen, right? And so long as, you know, there was sufficient time for the governor prior to the vote for the recall is not the person who is voted to be recalled, then the argument would be that the results of that plebiscite you would go to court and say, they are, null and void. Wow. Because there's no one to remove. You've gotten Holy the moly. Remedy that you want already. Yeah.
Okay. Well, in this hardball era, Gavin, I hope you're listening. Do this if it looks bad. Okay. Wow. Great question.
Yeah. Fantastic question. Never been tried. And I think, right, like a week beforehand. Yeah. You know, yeah. If you did some shenanigans as the votes are coming in, I could see a court saying, no. But if it's a week beforehand, a court would say, yeah, this matter is moot. You've gotten the relief that you want. Right. And the relief that you wanted was to remove Gavin Newsom from office.
Wow.
You cannot say because, and you would use the plurality factor, the worst aspect of the California recall. As a court, I would say the only thing that the recall provision of the Constitution affirmatively empowers as relief is removing the person from office, because the person who is then empowered to step into that spot can be elected with a very, very tiny minority, a tiny plurality of the remaining votes.
That's why this is such a dumb system. It's so terrible.
But yeah, but I would turn that on its head and say, therefore, right, there is no entitlement to relief among those who would otherwise have voted for the recall, right? You're not entitled. In other words, under the Constitution, regardless of how the outcome comes out, you cannot say that you had a legitimate interest in recalling Newsom and replacing him with someone else. Your only interest is recalling Newsom. And if you don't like the lieutenant governor, well, recall them, right? We're not going to stop you, right? But we are going to make sure that you get petitions that meet the criteria, right, and go through that whole process itself. So I agree with you. I don't think there's anything to stop other than giving the other side what they want. And that dovetails really, really nicely into a couple of comments we got from listeners, one of which is exceptional, on what is going to happen in this, right? And looking at the poll, and you and I talked about and had a good chuckle over the Survey USA poll, which showed YouTuber Kevin Paffrath with 27% of the vote becoming the next governor of the state of California, and Emerson College showing Kevin Paffrath with 1% becoming the next nothing of nothing. We made a crack about did his, you know, army of YouTubers come in and hack the polls or whatever.
I know. I legitimately think that something must have happened.
Well, let me share two comments with you. First is from a listener in the military who already got their mail-in ballot and already sent it in with just a no vote, leaving it blank before listening to our episode. At least they sent it in with a no, that's correct. But that person said, just so you know, Paffrath was listed as a YouTuber on the ballot, where it lists their qualification. Caitlyn Jenner was listed as entrepreneur. So I thought that was a good one. Then we have Michael McCourt, who wrote in And I'm going to read most of his comment, which says, as someone who follows polling a little too obsessively, I figured I would weigh in on the most recent episode where you discussed the recall election in California. You seem to be stumped by the difference between the SurveyUSA poll and the Emerson College poll. After reading the crosstab details provided by the two pollsters, it seems that SurveyUSA identified Kevin Paffrath as a Democrat, while Emerson College did not.
Oh.
To be fair, I could not find the exact text used for the question asked by SurveyUSA. Neither could I. That was part of why I didn't. But the results do identify him as a Democrat. And also, the SurveyUSA poll was conducted online, so the option choices were visually displayed, likely with the party identification as the letter D.
Okay.
And when you do look through to the crosstabs, remember that there are no organized Democratic candidates, right?
Mm-hmm.
So of those nine people who were ranked by SurveyUSA, eight are Republicans, and one is the Democrat Paffrath. So it is Paffrath and then all Republicans: Larry Elder, John Cox, Kevin Falconer, Doug Ose, Caitlin Jenner, Kevin Kiley, some other candidate, or undecided. And then Michael McQuirk goes on to say, so for that question, all the other name choices of Republicans, when you look at the 20%, 7% of respondents who said they would vote for Paffrath, you see that 50% said they were voting no on the recall, while only 12 are voting yes. So, yeah, and then we could go through. But if the way this poll was structured was you saw the party identification and you get to the second question that says, okay, if Newsom is recalled, who are you voting for? And there's only one Democrat listed. We should not be surprised that that one Democrat gets 27% of the vote and leads the field. That will not be the way this actually plays out, because actual voters will get the 3-page ballot with no clearly defined Democratic candidate on it, but, you know, 20 different Democrats to choose from, of whom they've never heard, right? So the idea that you would coalesce behind a single person on the long ballot, I think, is without any evidentiary support. And so I am going to treat, and I think everyone has treated, I've looked for polling since then, and no new has come out. But the idea that Paffrath is at 27% is not plausible.
Yeah. Someone goofed. I mean, that's not a good way to poll.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So no, but it doesn't seem like any hacking or anything crazy like that. So, okay. Well, that probably answers that. And we have hopefully enough time to get to our main segment.
That's what I love about this show. So last week was Mike Lindell's glorious, I don't even know what to call it, national broadcast in which he was going to prove how Dominion voting system stole the election. Delightfully, he claimed that the deep state was hacking his own broadcast because it suffered so many technical problems.
There's
actually an article, a credulous article, you know, run by the right-wing lunatics over at the Washington Times that says, Mike Lindell claims was hacked, you know. That's the best they can say is, you know, lunatics think so.
He also can't open a PDF. Ah, deep state is hacking my computer.
Gloriously, at the exact same time, right? So last Wednesday, right before we're recording this, the United States District Court for the District of Columbia ruled on the pending motions to dismiss in the consolidated Dominion defamation lawsuits cases, right? So you might recall Dominion sued Sidney Powell, sued Rudy Giuliani, and sued Mike Lindell and MyPillow. And those have all been consolidated into a single action because they're all operating out of the same common nucleus of operative facts. And all three of those parties moved to dismiss, but they moved to dismiss for very different reasons, largely because there aren't good reasons to move to dismiss here. And the court, in a 44-page ruling, decided that, nope, none of these are sufficient grounds for moving to dismiss. So I thought it would be worth kind of going back through this again, because, you know, you have somebody publicly repeating the very defamation for which they are being sued. And unlike the claims by crack-in lawyers who are present here, this is a valid and viable case. They have moved to dismiss and said, this is just, you know, a difference of political opinion. And the court's like, no, no, it isn't. When you say a particular company can turn 1.72 votes into 0.4, like, that's not an opinion. That is an actionable statement of fact. And if it's false, it's defamation against the company that is claiming that that they're running an honest vote tabulation company. So, Sidney Powell. And again, this is leftover from our discussions on sanctions in Michigan, but all of these people, the moment you are tempted to have the slightest bit of sympathy, you realize that they're all pigs drinking from the same trough. So who do you think Sidney Powell's lawyer, defending Sidney Powell, representing her in the Dominion defamation lawsuit is?
Lynn Wood.
Close. It's Howard Kleinhandler.
Oh, there you go.
So they're both representing clients in Michigan, but, you know, he's representing her in, and the reason is because they share a common set of insane beliefs and no one else does. And nobody, no self-respecting attorney would come in and represent Sidney Powell. So you got to get Howard Kleinhandler to do it. So the bases for the motion to dismiss, and again, Kleinhandler was the guy you looked at and you're like, well, this, you know, it seems like he's saying lawyer stuff, right? Yeah. And it's true. So his argument on behalf of Sidney Powell has more lawyer stuff in it than the Giuliani and Mike Lindell motions to dismiss. So first, Sidney Powell was the only one of the lawyers to argue, and this made some public headlines. We deconstructed it a little bit, that her statements about Dominion could not be defamatory because no reasonable person could conclude that they were statements of fact. According to Sidney Powell, her statements were either opinions that could not be proven true or false, or legal theories made in the context of pending and impending litigation. And you know from that tortured structure of the English language, I'm quoting directly from Sidney Powell's brief. The court was not impressed with this argument. It said, for a statement to be actionable as defamatory, it must at least express or imply a verifiably false fact about the plaintiff. And while statements of opinion regarding matters of public concern cannot be defamatory if they do not contain or imply a provably false fact, they are actionable if they imply a provably false fact or rely upon stated facts that are provably false. In deciding whether a reasonable fact finder could conclude that a statement expressed or implied a verifiably false fact, the court must consider the statement in context. So then it's like, all right, so let's look at Sidney Powell's context. Powell contends that no reasonable person could contend that her statements were statements of fact because they concern the 2020 presidential election, which was both bitter and controversial, and were made as an attorney advocate for her preferred candidate and in support of her legal and political positions. As an initial matter, there is no blanket immunity for statements that are political in nature. It is true that courts recognize the value of some level of imaginative expression or rhetorical hyperbole in our public debate, but it is not the law that provably false statements cannot be actionable if made in the context of an election. Okay, so try again.
Yeah.
Powell similarly argues that her statements were protected commentary about other lawsuits. But Powell cannot shield herself from liability for her widely disseminated out-of-court statements by casting them as protected statements about in-court litigation. An attorney's out-of-court statements to the public can be actionable even if those statements concern contemplated or ongoing litigation. So again, that argument is nonsense. So the question then is whether a reasonable juror could conclude that Powell's statements expressed or implied a verifiably false fact about Dominion. And then the court says, and again, I understand, dear listener, that you're used to my breaking down court opinions. And I talk like this all the time. Sitting, there's a reason why I am not a sitting U.S. District Court Justice, right? Sitting federal judges do not talk this way. So this is not a close call.
Spicy law smackdown incoming, everybody.
Yeah. This is not a close call. To take one example, Powell has stated publicly that she has evidence from the mouth of the guy who founded Dominion, admitting that he can change a million votes, no problem at all. She told audiences that she would tweet out the video. These statements are either true or not. Either Powell has a video depicting the founder of Dominion saying he can change a million votes, or she does not. She has not tweeted out the video, by the way. Take another example, Powell has stated that she could hardly wait to put forth all the evidence on Dominion, starting with the fact that it was created to produce altered voting results in Venezuela for Hugo Chavez. Again, the statement is either true or not. Either Dominion was created to produce altered voting results in Venezuela for Hugo Chavez, or, as Dominion alleges, it was not.
Well, I'm picking that it's not true, and the coin picks that it is. Sorry, go ahead.
And then it goes on, right? So take a few more examples. I'm not going to read it. The court then says, in sum, Dominion has adequately alleged that Powell made a number of statements that are actionable because a reasonable juror could conclude that they were either statements of facts or statements of opinion that implied or relied upon facts that are provably false.
We've been telling
you this from the beginning.
Going for the, that's just my opinion, man. Defense or something.
Yep.
It's my opinion that I have a video that the president of the company in which he says that he can change a million votes. That doesn't really, again, the law is not just magic words, really. I mean, sometimes, but not.
It really isn't. So, next argument, this was made by both Sidney Powell and Mike Lindell. They said, look, Dominion is a public figure, so you have failed to allege that our defamatory statements, if they are defamatory, were made with actual malice, that is, with the knowledge that they were false or with reckless disregard of whether they were false or not. So then the court says, well, let's take a look at it. Dominion argues that it has cleared this high bar. As to Powell, Dominion contends that it is alleged that not only that Powell's claims are so inherently improbable that only a reckless person could have believed them.
Yeah.
I love that. But also that she deliberately ignored the truth in favor of relying on facially unreliable sources, intentionally lied about and fabricated evidence to support a preconceived narrative about election fraud, and did so to raise her own public profile and make a profit. Yes. Powell's primary argument is that she could not have entertained serious doubts as to the truth or acted with a high degree of awareness of the probable falsity of her claims because she relied on sworn declarations and other evidence that supported her statements. But there is no rule that a defendant cannot act in a reckless disregard of the truth when relying on sworn affidavits, especially sworn affidavits that the defendant had a role in creating. And Dominion alleges that Powell's, quote, evidence was either falsified by Powell herself, misrepresented and cherry-picked, or so obviously unreliable that Powell had to have known it was false or acted with reckless disregard for the truth. Now, this is the court. So those are the arguments that were made. Here's the court weighing in. Powell, again, faces an obvious hurdle in the fact that she has never produced nor mentioned in any sworn affidavit the video of Dominion's founder that she claims to possess. See Super at page 6. A reasonable juror could conclude that Powell has not produced the video because she doesn't have it. You may be thinking that I am paraphrasing. That is word for word. She doesn't have it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dominion also alleges that Powell doctored a certificate from the Georgia Secretary of State to make it appear as though Georgia officials purchased Dominion machines and software on a rush timeline. Wow. This certificate, which is publicly available on the Georgia Secretary of State's website, includes the Georgia Secretary of State's date, seal, and signature, but Powell claimed that the Dominion certification was undated and filed a copy of the certificate that was missing the date, seal, and signature during the course of her election litigation in Georgia. Dominion also alleges, you know where this one's coming, that Powell had a hand in drafting the declaration she touts as evidence of her claims. For example, Dominion alleges that the military intelligence expert who was the source for one declaration has admitted he never worked in military intelligence, that the declaration Powell's law firm drafted for him was misleading, and that he was trying to backtrack on it. That's Spider.
Yep.
Dominion further alleges that after that source's recantation, Powell claimed that the declaration was actually from a different anonymous source instead of investigating whether there was a reason to doubt the truth of the original source's claims. Yeah. As for the other anonymous declarations proffered by Powell, Dominion alleges that they bear distinct signs of having been drafted by Powell herself. Certain sections of two of the declarations are almost completely identical. And then goes into the lack of facts, that the expert reports are inherently unreliable, that they had good reason. There was an expert who publicly claimed that George Soros, President George H.W. Bush's father, Prescott Bush, the Muslim Brotherhood, and leftists helped the deep state form Nazi Germany in the 1930s, which would have been a remarkable feat for Soros, who was born in 1930. The court goes on for 8 pages saying, you relied on nonsense. Dominion has adequately alleged that Powell made her claims knowing they were false, or at least with serious doubts as to their truthfulness. What about Mike Lindell? Mike Lindell, Dominion contends that his claims were so inherently improbable that only a reckless man would have made them, that he intentionally disregarded evidence of their falsity, that he relied on obviously unreliable sources, and made his claims in accordance with the preconceived narrative that he constructed for financial gain. All of which, you know, seems to be true. For the profit motive, Dominion alleges that Lindell knew that appealing to Trump supporters would be good for business, and that his true motive is apparent in the repeated tying together of his election fraud claims and the promotion of MyPillow products. And there is, like, he went on Seb Gorka's podcast and said, if any, you know, true patriots and supporters of President Trump, you can use the code, the promo code Gorka to get, you know, 50% off of a MyPillow, you know. Like Powell, Lindell correctly notes that the allegations of a defendant's ill will or profit motive without more do not satisfy the actual malice standard. But again, Dominion has alleged more. In addition to alleging that Lindell's claims are inherently improbable, that his sources are unreliable, that he has failed to acknowledge the validity of the countervailing evidence, Dominion has also alleged numerous instances in which Lindell told audiences to purchase MyPillow products after making his claims of election fraud and providing MyPillow promotional codes related to those theories. In totality, it is adequately alleged that Lindell made his claims knowing they were false or with reckless disregard for the truth.
Wow.
I'm gonna skip over the personal jurisdiction argument, the deceptive trade practices claims, but again, they get smacked down on the law on all of these, right? So these are some technical legal arguments of, you know, hey, I didn't really do anything in Washington, D.C., so you have no personal jurisdiction over me, or you should transfer this matter to either Texas, which is where Sidney Powell wants to transfer it, or to the District of Minnesota, which is where Mike Lindell wants to transfer it. And the court's like, no, you are on TV in Washington, D.C. all the time. This is about the President of the United States. We're not transferring the case. This court has adequate jurisdiction over you. You might notice that I have not mentioned everyone's favorite decomposing lawyer at this point, Rudy Giuliani. And that is because Rudy Giuliani declined to join the losing arguments made by Sidney Powell and Mike Lindell in favor of a different kind of losing argument. And this is a Rule 9 motion to dismiss. It has three parts. First, that Dominion is a corporation and may therefore only recover lost profits. Second, that lost profits are special damages subject to Rule 9G's heightened pleading requirements, which Dominion has failed to satisfy. And third, that each individual corporate entity must plead its own damages amount instead of pleading damages as a group. It's always fun when the court begins with, it is easiest to start with Giuliani's third argument, which goes to the court's subject matter jurisdiction. Giuliani argues that the complaint should be dismissed because the three corporate plaintiffs have failed to plead distinct legal injuries that are unique to each plaintiff. And then the court says, yeah, that's not the law. For a plaintiff to establish standing under Article 3, it must show, among other things, that it has suffered an injury in fact that is concrete and particularized. It must exceed the diversity requirements, which you know are $75,000. Since this is for $1 billion, it exceeds
that. I've answered 100 questions in a row on that.
Yep. Giuliani does not seriously dispute that the plaintiffs have alleged an injury in fact, nor does he argue that they have failed to allege complete diversity, nor does he contend that they have failed to plead over $75,000 in damages. Instead, Giuliani argues that each plaintiff must plead that it has suffered more than $75,000 in damages, and that all plaintiffs have failed to do so because the complaint alleges amounts only with respect to Dominion, which for purposes of the complaint refers to all three corporate plaintiffs. And then the court says, with respect to suits brought under 1332, which is the diversity statute, the sum claimed by the plaintiff controls if the claim is apparently made in good faith. So, no.
Yeah, so this is just a real attempt to get out on a technicality, it sounds like.
Yeah, so look.
And some of your best friends are technicalities. But,
yeah, that's right. Look, there is real litigation here when you have a state claim. It's obviously not enough to satisfy the jurisdictional amount. And so you start adding in multiple plaintiffs with multiple right? And you're just trying to get over that $75,000 hurdle by aggregating a bunch of things together that don't actually belong, right? And there's a fair amount of case law on that. This is not that case, right? Because again, Dominion has alleged $1 billion in damages. So, you know, it didn't need help from its other corporate entities to get over the $75,000 line. $75,000 isn't a rounding error for $1 billion, right?
Yeah.
And the court notes that to reject the presumption, it must appear to a legal certainty that the claim is really for less than the jurisdictional amount. And then it says, and again, drawing reasonable inferences in the plaintiff's favor, each corporate entity has pleaded injuries exceeding $75,000. At the very least, plaintiffs allege a total of $651,735,000 in damages, which obviously means that at least one plaintiff suffered more than $75,000 in damages. Thus, even if two of the Dominion plaintiffs had not individually pleaded that they met the amount in controversy requirement, the court could exercise supplemental jurisdiction over their claims. You just answered a question on that, right?
All right.
So when cases are inextricably linked, even if each and every element does not satisfy each and every element of diversity, you could still maintain supplemental jurisdiction. So it's working its way backwards. It's like, all right, the amount in controversy is a super dumb argument. Next, Giuliani argues that Dominion is required to and has not pled lost profits with the specificity required by Federal Rule Civil Procedure 9G. This argument rests on the premise that Dominion is required to plead damages for its defamation claim. Under DC law, defamation may be actionable as a matter of law, irrespective of actual harm, that is, defamation per se, or, if not, when the plaintiff pleads special harm. There is no question that Giuliani's statements accusing Dominion of election fraud constitute defamation per se. If Dominion were an individual, damages would be presumed. Right. And we've talked about that before. Usually damages are an element of the claim. Some things in defamation are so bad that you can allege them without having to say you've suffered any damages. Right.
And yeah, those old timey like character things like if
there's the loathsome disease. Part, right. Yeah. and look. Breaking the law is like having a loathsome disease. It is defamation per se. Giuliani contends that damages are not presumed for corporate plaintiffs in the defamation per se context. He relies on three separate cases, right? The first is dicta, the second two are irrelevant, and finally, concluding, the court is not aware of any case requiring a corporate plaintiff alleging defamation per se to plead damages specially, right? That is to itemize them. And by its terms, Rule 9G does not include such a requirement. In any event, Dominion has pled lost profits with the particularity required by 9G. Under that rule, a defamation plaintiff must set forth the precise nature of its losses, as well as the way in which the special damages resulted from the allegedly false publication. Here, Dominion alleges that Giuliani made defamatory statements about its involvement in the 2020 election, that the people who believe those statements made threats to Dominion employees and board members, and that those threats required Dominion to spend more than $565,000 on private security to protect its employees. And I wanted to highlight that because you may recall that $565,000 number. That was precisely the area of the complaint that I zoomed in on back in January when we first covered when this was filed. And I said, I don't know if Dominion's going to get $1 billion, but they're definitely going to get the $565,000 for increased security, right? Hmm. It is very clear. This is the
that's
the
a pittance,
textbook.
Though. I hope that's not all they
oh,
get.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. But it was in there to survive, to allow the court to say precisely this, which is, yep, you have specifically itemized the particularized damage that you have suffered as a result of this defamation, right? Like you do not get a more particularized list of your damages than saying they said X. After they said X, lunatics started showing up at our facilities and we had to hire a whole bunch of security guards. And here's the receipt for those security guards, right? Like that is as clear as 9G gets, right? In terms of identifying with specificity, as compared to, oh, and by the way, this has also hurt us in a number of other ways, right, which are all outlined in the motion to dismiss. And again, I pointed out Rudy Giuliani failed to join with Sidney Powell and Mike Lindell on the, no, this isn't defamation. This is just, you know, this is all just ephemeral opinion stuff, presumably because he thought those arguments sucked, which they did. Sidney Powell, Howard Kleinhandler, and the MyPillow guy declined to join in with Rudy Giuliani on the no, this is definitely not specific enough to constitute damages and defamation claim, presumably because they thought those arguments sucked. Happily, that means, despite the outcome, each of them were right about a thing. And so I think we should be happy for them for that. So for the foregoing reasons, this is great. I just love, the court denies defendants' motions to dismiss in full. Period.
Yeah, no kidding. And we're resentful that you made us even explain some of those.
Exactly right. In contrast to the imaginary Kraken lawsuits that went nowhere, as we told you, this is the Dominion lawsuits against the individuals spreading the big lie about the election are valid and will go forward. And
yeah.
And I, for one, and love to see.
You know, I know we've broken it down, but like my impression from doing the show with you is that these are kind of high bars usually for cases like this, like defamation, yeah. You know, and this seems to clear all that. It survived the motions to dismiss. Gosh, I really am just rooting for Dominion so hard.
I know. I feel a little bad. Like
massive judgments against these assholes for what they've done. And there's legitimate, I mean, honestly, you know, forget all the politics. Imagine if you just ran a business of some kind. And then these people come along and spread all these very definitely fact claim type lies about your business and how horrible it is and how you cheat and do all this. Like, they owe you money when it turns out that they completely fabricated it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's why defamation exists.
Yeah. All right. Just goes to show you how confident we are in our crowd health is a scam episode.
It does indeed.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE answer time. Ooh, it feels like this was another straightforward one. I'm worried how many straightforward ones I get in a row. So maybe I got it wrong. Let's find out.
Yeah, all right, Thomas. This was, with impeccable timing, a question about an insurance
crowd
policy.
Crowd health.
Yeah. A man brought a federal diversity action against his insurance company. And again, that's just to say, use federal law here, right?
So yeah.
In particular, the federal rules of civil procedure to adjudicate, because not every state's internal civil procedures match the FRCP. So sued his insurance company, alleging that the company breached its duty under the policy by refusing to pay for his mountain biking accident. At the trial, the man presented evidence that he paid the premiums, that the policy covered personal injury-related medical expenses arising from the accidents, then rested his case. After he rested his case, the company presented evidence that the policy contained an exclusion for unduly risky behavior, and then put on a witness to say, yeah, that accident occurred in an area where there were posted signs that warned bikers not to enter. The man declined to cross-examine the witness, and then the company closes, it arrests its case and moves for judgment as a matter of law, which we have talked about on the show. That is where you say, no, take this away from the jury. There is no question of fact for the jury to resolve here. There is no way to find legally the other way. So we shouldn't even risk it, right? We should just, you, the judge, should enter judgment as a matter of law. So, should the court grant the motion? You instantly eliminated A, no, because a motion for judgment as a matter of law must be made at the close of the plaintiff's case in chief. Good elimination. I will tell you that this may trip up some of the lawyers who listen to the show, because the reason this is an attractive distractor is that, as a matter of course, whenever the if you're the defense counsel,
that's
whenever
when
the plaintiff
you would do
rests,
it.
You would move. You would say, Your Honor, we move for judgment as a matter of law. Plaintiffs have not met their prima facie burden. And who knows, right? I've never
had it. Yeah, it's sort of like, it just strikes me as like you just take a swing at it. You know, why not? Like, their case was so bad, we don't even want to do any work. Just dismiss or whatever.
That's right.
Judge based on law.
And it has happened, It has not happened to me, but
I could conceive of that. I mean, I'm not the lawyer, but that doesn't seem like, you know, that out of the ordinary that someone would think they made a case and then you're like, hey, actually you didn't really make any case here and we're done. And that could happen, right?
Yeah. And particularly as you go down the scale.
Right? Yeah. And I represent myself and I sue somebody.
Yeah, for something. Exactly right. So a motion for judgment as a matter of law may be made at any time before the judge submits the case to the jury. So you can make it. You can then renew it at the close of your own case in chief. And again, that's typically, that has been the result that has happened in my cases, right? Where you move for judgment as a matter of law after the plaintiff's case in chief, and the judge says, I'm going to keep that motion sub curiae, put on your case, counselor. Then you put on the defense case, you renew your motion, and the judge says, the motion is denied. It's going to the jury, or grants it, right? And again, that can happen. You also eliminated D, yes, because the man waived his right to rebut the company's evidence by not addressing the unduly risky policy provision in his case in chief. And you said, that seems like kind of gobbledygook. It's a good elimination, but it actually isn't gobbledygook.
Okay.
The question is, in your case in chief, you have to make out a prima facie case of what you're suing for here, right?
Okay.
So it explicitly, the factual paragraph explicitly shows that the plaintiff did that, right? I paid my policy. Mm-hmm. Policy covered personal injury-related medical expenses. This is a personal injury-related medical expense. A policy exclusion. Oh, yeah. But your policy doesn't cover unduly risky behavior is an affirmative defense, right?
Okay.
So it's not surprising to see the insurance company defendant raise that in their case. But this argument is you should have addressed the exclusions in your case in chief, which, no, you just have to make out a prima facie case. However, if the coverage, right, if it had specifically said, if the coverage had said the policy covers all reasonable personal injury related medical expenses and you didn't prove that it was reasonable, that would have shifted the burden back to you, okay. Right? So, you know, it's
true. But one way or the other, does that even talk about the question of whether or not it should be moved for judgment as a matter of law? Or
that's a great question. If the unduly risky, right? Suppose that instead of this being listed in the policy exclusions, which are then raised as an affirmative defense by the insurer, suppose the coverage line had said, we agree to cover all
not risky.
All personal injury related expenses that are not unduly risky. Then I think you would have a good argument that you have to, in your case in chief, prove that it's not. You have to at least address that. You have to say, okay, I paid my premiums. The policy covers all non-unduly risky accidents. This was an accident, and this was not unduly risky because of X. Yeah,
I hear you. I still feel like this could be gobbledygook because the question says, the man waived his right to rebut the company's evidence. So like you would lose your right to even rebut.
Oh, yeah. You know what? You know what? I wasn't reading it that carefully. Withdrawn, counselor.
All right. Well, I feel like even if I got this wrong, I should get a point for that.
I feel like that way too. So now the question is, you and the coin took B, no, because whether the man's behavior was unduly risky is a question of fact for the jury to resolve. Leaving out C, yes, because the company's uncontradicted evidence of the man's unduly risky behavior means that no reasonable jury could find that the policy covers his injuries. And I want to tell you, you got this one correct, Thomas.
Oh, man, I was a little worried on that one.
I loved your analysis, though. There is no per se rule that says you have to cross-examine a witness. The question is this something that goes to the credibility of the witness, or is this something where, you know, if there's no uncontradicted evidence that even when, you know, in the law, we say, you know, you, for example, in summary judgment, you construe all inferences in favor of the plaintiff, you know, the non-moving party. Mm. The question would be, all right, even if we're giving you every possible benefit of the doubt, is there any factual doubt here? Well, and here you would say, yeah, this is a company witness who who testified that the accident occurred in an area where posted signs warned bikers not to enter. Well, you could not enter an area. It could be Area 51, right? Like it could be you're not allowed to enter for a lot of different reasons. That doesn't say.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
As a matter of law that it's unduly risky.
Good point.
This would be a harder question if the testimony were uncontradicted testimony that it was.
The guy was doing tricks on his bike.
Yeah. Unduly risky to do here. And they had photographs and they put on an expert. Who
So that's what I was going to ask you is what if this weren't a witness? What if it was some sort of, I don't know, enter into evidence this photo of him doing a wheelie or whatever. And they and he didn't contradict it. Would that still would that then change it to C possibly?
Well, so that would still be introduced via witness, right? You would still need a witness to authenticate the document. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of where I'm going to is I don't think a single photo of him doing a wheelie would have been sufficient, but I don't want us to make, I don't want you to make the mistake next time of going too far in the opposite direction of saying, you could just not cross-examine anyone you please. That's true. But at some point, the cumulative effect of the evidence will be such that the court will say, all right, there's nothing left here. Right?
That feels like a really hard call to make for me as an answerer of these things, like what will be on that, cross that line.
I agree.
So we'll see.
And I think it would be very, very difficult, right? Like this question would have been, impossible if the sign said danger, falling rock ahead, right? You know what I mean? Like you switch up the evidence a little bit and now it is, okay, do you have to do something to contradict the evidence that you engaged in unduly risky behavior? Witness credibility is always the thing that, you know, you're free to say, I didn't, you know, this is a company show.
That's what I
thought.
I mean, it's free for the jury to be like, well, he's wearing a, you know, a t-shirt with the name of the company on it. Like, clear, this guy's a plant or something, something. He's sweating profusely.
He's sweating. Well, that's true. That is often a jury.
It leaves room for all these inferences for the jury to make, I think, right?
I think that's correct.
An old man with giant bottle lens glasses, you know, like, okay. So we nailed this one, the coin and I. Good for the coin. Good for me. I'm happy. Who else nailed this one? Who's our big winner of T3BE this week?
Well, Thomas, this week's winner is Mortgage Talkin' Guy on Twitter who writes, B, even if plaintiff punted on the location of the accident, the defendant hasn't proven that this is a lack of due care as a matter of law. Fact? Maybe, but that's what juries are for. Well, exactly right for exactly the right reasons. Very, very pithy, kind of funny. And hey, Mortgage Talkin' Guy, congratulations on being this week's winner. So everyone, give them a follow. They are at njordan79, njordan79 on Twitter. Mortgage Talkin' Guy, congratulations on being this week's winner.
And thank you!
And now it's time, because I haven't set out a Patreon poll yet, it's time to thank our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats, because we are still contractually obligated to do so at patreon.com/law. Hope you're enjoying all the goodies. Hope you enjoyed the puzzle takes the bar exam. So much fun. The Lot Awful movie's coming at you very soon. Thank you to British Paratrooper School, Class of 1942. Atomic Penguin, at Atomic Penguin 7 on Twitter. Still Want Wilkie. Joseph Vigiano, Ghost Dog, Statehood for DC and Puerto Rico Now, Dr. Scoop Little. Now here's something we hope you'll really like. Alex Drop Table Patron _ shoutouts. Comedian Aaron Trahan, aka Game Jumper X. Handwoven machine washable natural fibers, KellyWoveIt.com. Trains are the most fuel efficient way to move cargo in the world. Cool. Yeah, we need more trains around here. That Thing in the Attic. The Fat Jedi Eating Cake and Drinking Emperor's Brewery Beer in the Death Star Canteen. Republicans promised me court packing if Biden got elected. Where's my pack court? Liberals own guns too. Support root cause mitigation, not ineffective gun control. That Guy. Check out Gems of Truth and Beauty, a creative guided journal for personal growth by Hope Wallace. Good credit, bad credit, no credit. Come on down to Throckmorton Fraud. Throckmorton Fraud. Throckmorton Fraud. Teo. 100% Thomas deserves way more credit for his role in making the left-wing, non-shitty atheist podcastosphere. Thank you. January 20, baby. Social Justice Alchemy, up with unions. January 21st, baby leftovers. Andrew Thomas can read your name in 15 minutes or less while supplies last. Tell Morgan, Gatom's son, Zach Bloom, Ray, Pizza School the Corgi, says congrats to Angus for winning 2021 Emerald Downs Corgi Races. LiveBaseballScorecards.com. Legal Eagle is so handsome. California employment, work accident, or litigation questions, call or text attorney David Nitka, 310-776-5879. Again, 310-776-5879. The Smiths, praise be unto Hamilton. EMS in my area starts at $9 an hour. Vote to make us essential, not just expendable. I agree. That Manchin is vote 50 is our fault, not his, so let's get at it. I get a raise, you get a raise. Crazy dog, horse, goat, chicken lady loves the shout-outs and hopes you keep them. I upgrade to Hall of Fame for this. Well, that's a firm vote. Rest in peace, Brandon Bernard. We must abolish the death penalty. Budget Botanist is on vacation, so no Fiverr plant help, but does have a plant law episode idea, seconding Raleigh Live Show. PSA studies have shown listening to Patreon names linked with increases to productivity, happiness, and libido. Sparkle Donkey Tequila, Botanist of the Week is Budget Botanist, a rare fiber-based biologist that produces neat plant facts. That's fantastic.
That's excellent.
Perpetually exhausted East Coast Mary, one fabulous lesbian taking forever to play a game of chess. Sorry for making y'all try to say my friend's cat's name. I was proving to her that I'm a patron. LOL, Rouge. Oops. One year. So because they typed Rouge instead of Rogue last time, they're LOL Rouge. One blue instant. You may exile a blue card from your hand instead of playing this card's cost. Counter target non-creature spell. Is that Oh, I had it and I lost it. Dismiss? Crap. Well, anyway, it's a great counter spell with a cost of, you have to exile a blue card. Or no, it's an optional cost of exiling a blue card. So it's like a force of will, but for non-creature spells. I think that's one of the newer ones that I don't have as much experience playing with. Anyway, I hate PETA Malark. That's a different tone from the last one. Just get the clown-horning vaccine, you clown-horning clown horns. I agree. Adam Borchoff, I like my pork streaks paired with at Casa Agria and at Emperor's Brewery beer. 75% of Tulare County's DAs have less than 2 years experience and they're doing felonies. Some are only provisionally licensed. Since internet petitions are the best way to affect change, let's start one to get Andrew on the federal bench. Yeah. Lee Sharp, GDT says mining billionaire Clive Palmer suing Western Australia for vaccinating people is ridiculous. Wow. Wow. Talk about a lot awful lawsuit. Thomas Kleberg, Benghazi and the Buttery Males, Brian K, Buddy Freakin' Guyerson, followed Morgan on Twitter, now seeing different side of the platform. Supreme Court justices should have just 18-year term limits, and so should Conrad Michaels. No coin at this firm has ever failed the bar exam. Two fabulous lesbians met a family that moved from a red state to protect their trans kid. Our own country is our newest source of LGBTQ refugees. Wow. Edgy Veggie. Les deux les bien fabuleux. Bob Newhouse. Sassy Italy tours. Can't wait for Europe to be open again. Jennifer Chikowski, D&D minus cameo question mark. We have legal advice if ye have coin. Do not take legal advice from a coin. Mutually supported communities are hard to oppress. Join or create a local mutual aid group. Mike Hall, E.V. Huntington, Harvard alum, no hood. 3NC8, Queen D8, sorry I'm late. Yes, this is a real defense, I promise. I enjoy mocking people who mispronounce adopted French words that mean a peculiar ability. I guess I am a fort teaser. Oh, so fluffy Torsten Peel of the Satanic Temple. Elect Thomas Smith President, American Honky Tonk Bar Association. Support your local Peruvian restaurant. Angry Macface. There's a goat. Why is there a goat? Penelope is glad Sydney got sanctioned for Terpsichore. Yeah. The Books That Burn podcast, reviewing fictional depictions of trauma since 2019. This is not the greatest patron name in the world. No, this is just a tribute. Support AfricaPartnersMedical.org, providing volunteer U.S. MDs and RNs to bring the latest science-based practice to African MDs or RNs. Oh, Wayne, anyone who ever lost at poker knows better than to try bluffing a Texas bankruptcy judge. Murray Gregerson, you're not drunk, I'm drunk. Wait, what? Never mind. Dude, what? You're drunk. Come on, man. Minneapolis live show. Come for the subpar baseball, stay for the subpar football, hockey, and men's basketball. too lazy to make a clever joke about being too lazy to update my Patreon name. Actually, we can stop reading patron names anytime we want. It's not a contract, and consideration is ongoing. Congrats to Ben for published paper on conspiracy theories and social media. Yeah, congrats. Society for the Protection of the Third Amendment, celebrating a perfect record since 1792. Put your boss on a performance improvement plan. Pass the PRO Act. Since they have the Kraken lawsuits, can we have the Godzilla sanctions? Kaiju court battle. Jake, Seattle Pete, Crimer, no criming. Guardian ad litem, Godot, and the Justice League. And Christopher Brown. Whew, your turn, Andrew.
Thank you to Sam Cedar. Philly Live Show 2022. I'll bring the scotch and cheese steaks. Who's bringing gritty? Lawful Copter says, Andrew and Thomas, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for everything you guys do. MR. OA Live Show in Sydney, Australia, please. I won't be vaccinated till October at the earliest. Thanks, government. Objection. Strangling Uncle Frank. I'm going to allow it. Odin's bar exam pro tip, don't flip a coin unless it's an approved accommodation. 2, 4, 6, 8, some chance don't rhyme. That makes me giggle every time. Robert M. Lou, hold up in Japan, hiding from Delta. Get my vax next month. If I die, mix my ashes with glitter and mail them to the IOC. All right.
Wow.
OA brand Howler Monkey Voodoo Dolls. Put a pin in that. Nikomo Koska, famed soldier of fortune, at your service. Now that Andrew has mentioned scrums and rugby, OA is my favorite rugby analysis podcast. Yeah, go All Blacks. Marble Distillery Live Show, Polly Hernandez. These are just simple farmers, people of the land, the common clay of the New West. You know, morons. Emily Rainbow Spence, the best cardboard crack dealer in the Maritimes, thedeckboxhalifax.com. Another Minneapolitan waiting for our live show in Minneapolis, Jason Copas, the New York state flag is ugly AF. Medicon 7 has a pot for pins and a pot for beans. Yes, you do. Ian Hamilton, hey, Arizona, support Aaron Lieberman for governor. Spent my charity budget for the year. Help. Need everyone to roast the coin on Vulgarity for Charity. Oh, that'd be great. Stop calling him Uncle Frank. Nate Drex has to call him Dad. HIPAA pot amus violation. Definitely not an MSNBC spy. Yeah, yeah, sure. So says the...
MSNBC spy.
I was going to say Last Week Tonight, but either way. Definitely a spy.
Oh, right.
My fully stock basement bar is your fully stock basement bar for a Philly Live Show Platinum event. You pick what's on tap. Ooh. Jeff Gelbach, Jennifer Kratch, the butt of Andrew Torres. All right. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. Laughing my ass off because Thomas knows more about the law than a coin does. John Bilderback, my friend's cousin mixed coke with cop rocks and he died. Stephen Balticate Sandoval, the reading of Hall of Fame patron names will continue until the filibuster is abolished. It's excellent. GiveToModestNeeds.org, GiveToModestNeeds.org. Philip Kaiser, Andrea the Arbitrary and Capricious, not that Chris Wallace. COVID showed me I am the kind of guy who wants a little prick. Today marks 11 years since I was given 8 to 10 years to live, and I'd like to thank OA for helping me smile as my body falls apart.
Wow.
Wow. Well, thank you for...
Holy smokes.
Yeah, sharing that with us. We're glad we're able to bring some joy into your life. Abzion, sorry for making you use the last one for so long. It was dumb anyway. Pain strumpet, dude. Jonathan, Lord Kimbote. No, Your Honor, I am not a cat, nor am I a potted plant, but I am a karaoke legend, if that helps. Check out Project Binky on YouTube. Two mad blokes fit a Toyota GT4 all-wheel drive drivetrain into an original Mini. Milo Meadsong wishes all Stephen Breyers a happy retire now. Join your labor union together. We bargain alone, we beg. Never tell the taint team to put a pin in it. Alfred Wallace. Peter Piper bequeathed pickle peppers producing pickle pepper perpetuities. The swordfish has no natural enemies, except for the even mightier penfish. Andrew is always fantastic because Thomas's theme music holds the rights to fabulous. False. Anonymous. WordOrigins.org, your source for word and phrase origins. My witty names aren't original, and my original names aren't witty. A series of bar suspensions, each more suspendy than the last. RIP, Notorious RBG. Nerd Gnostic sells art on Society 6. They said I could be anything, so I became two fabulous lesbians. Derek, former undisclosed Red State senior executive branch official, now figuring out next gig. That is true, by the way. Big Easy Blasphemy. It's kind of nice having a competent federal government again. SummitShuffleboard.com. Please be kind to your veterinarian. We are overwhelmed and doing the best we can. Okay. a string of unpronounceable characters, RondaTheDork.com, Malika Chandler. They said I could be anything, so I became two princes who adore you. Soggy Pants, support bikeable cities to save America from the scourge of Eli Bosnick in a car. Sakashite Fukusumi, oh America, where there's a lower bar to removing an elected governor than passing a bill in the Senate. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Day Jury Belly at Packy's at last, baby. Heather L. Matthew Vernon. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium. In an Alley. Danny Rosari. Adam Costa. Eli Bosnick. The only Krakens this country needs are the ones that will be beating the Sharks next season. Ooh, shots fired. Teresa Gomez. David in Brooklyn. Sam Danal. Mitchell. I'm sympathetic to this patron name. Does anyone else smell Indian food? Oh, hi, Noah. I agree with that 100%. Natasha Crunchwrap wants you to support the Justice Policy Institute. Sam Buck, and of course, our all-time great, he who shall never be dethroned, Conrad Michaels.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. It is a pleasure to hear about bad people who lied about the election facing some consequences. I'll never get tired of it, Andrew. That's my favorite topic we cover for now.
Me too.
And we'll see you for Rapid Response Friday.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use, and be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.